business is hard. And if you tell yourself, as long as I solve all my problems, then I'll be happy, I think you're on the wrong path. Instead, I would employ anybody to like dive into, what do you want? What's worked for you in the past? And specifically not shying away from problems. The key to life isn't solving your problems and then you feel good. The key to life is...
What's one thing every business leader would fear? How about being sued by a billion-dollar competitor? But what if you could turn that lawsuit into your greatest opportunity? That's exactly what my guest today, Bennett Maxwell, did. He transformed a David versus Goliath legal battle into a marketing goldmine, growing his cookie company from 60 to 290 franchise locations in under 6 months. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because we believe great leaders aren't born or made, they are constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby, two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Bennett Maxwell about how he turned an apparent disaster into opportunities for explosive business growth. I'm going to be asking Bennett to share his insights on professional communication strategies, how to build world-class advisory boards, and maintaining mental health while scaling a business. What role did knocking on doors play in your sales journey, and how has it shaped your success both in sales and entrepreneurship?
Super good question. Man, anybody who asks me, like, I'm part of some program of the DECA high school or something, you know, mentoring some kids. And I tell them, listen, just go knock on some doors. Because if you go knock on 10,000 doors, you will be a better communicator. So I think it comes down to communication. When I knocked on doors, there's a big piece of recruiting as well. You're recruiting, you're managing, you're training, and it's everything is 100% commission-based. I was also very successful on the recruiting side because as I recruited people, it wasn't like, hey, this company is going to pay you $50,000. These guys are $60,000 and we're $70,000. It was like, forget about that. What do you want to do with your life? I want to be an author. Okay. Tell me how, if I can't teach you how to knock on a door, grab somebody's attention when their kids are in the bath and their dog's barking, and sell them a year-long contract within 15 minutes and peace out. Like, tell me how that's not going to make you be a better author, doctor, teacher, accountant, construction worker. You know what I mean? So I focused on the sales skills, and I guess that's where my answer is going towards. Every interaction is a sell, including me trying to sell you and all the listeners that every interaction is a sell, right? So diving into that door-to-door and kind of shaking off the, no, Damon, I don't want pest control because I hate you as a person, and interpreting it as more likely what it is, as no, I'm just not interested, go to the next door, right? If you could separate yourself emotionally from that outcome, then it allows you to take a lot more risk because you're not really operating as much as out of fear, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think we're all in sales in one way or the other. And going back to, I've heard you say this before, professional communication is so key. What is an example of how knocking on doors has helped you become a better communicator?
The thing that I applied the most to knocking doors that relates to me now, I think it came from the rich dad, poor dad. But it's all about learning. So I'm knocking doors, making good money as a pest control sales rep at 22, 23 year old, you know, making $250,000 in 4 or 5 months. But there's other people making more, you know, not that I needed more, but I adapted the mentality of what is that guy doing, saying, what's he doing with his face? How is he standing? What's he doing that I can't learn? And that mentality then kind of translates really well to sales. If I'm getting an objection, how am I going to craft my pitch to not get that objection again? So a common objection is, you know, oh, I don't have, you know, they open the door. They're like, oh gosh, I don't have any time. Right. Let's say that. If they open up the door, you open up the door before you say, oh crap, I don't have any time. I say, hey, I don't have much time. I'll be quick. I can guarantee what you're not going to say is, oh, well, I also don't have much time. You know, hey, you're the 20th guy that knocked on my door. Okay. I'm going to knock on the door. They're going to open it up. And I say, hey, how's it going? I know what you're thinking. You're probably thinking, is this another damn solar sales rep? Probably the 20th guy this year. They laugh. I laugh. And what they don't say is, hey, you're the 20th guy on my, you know. So learning how to, knowing that there's a solution to everything, you just need to find it, and then applying it to sales, it's just so easy with door to door. It's like, OK, okay, that's the fourth time I got this objection. How do I overcome it before they bring it up? And then that translates to raising capital. I didn't have any experience with that to fuel Dirty Dough's growth in the last 2 years. I raised $9 million and it was same sales concepts, right? Same outreach, same referrals, same everything I did with door to door translated almost perfectly to raising money to fuel the franchise company.
No, I think that's great. And what I hear you saying is anticipating objections really when it comes to it and it comes to learning, right? So if you're in sales, whether you're knocking on doors or you're cold calling or whatever it is you're doing, if you get ahead of it, then you kind of put them almost on the defensive and sometimes they can even laugh. So I think that's awesome.
And that's the communication. So that's the answer to like, what is the communication? How does that, you're a professional communicator by foreseeing their needs as much as possible. You know, like that's what professional communication is. And if you can't, then you're asking the right questions, right? But what you're not doing is just shoving crappy information down their throat and hoping that they buy at the end.
Now, another area that I really like what I've, since I've been researching you, is how you talk about putting a value to your time. Can you share a little bit about how you go about doing that?
Yeah. If you're straight commission, it's easy, right? So I have to make how many phone calls? We'll stick with door to door. How many doors do I have to knock to get somebody to answer? Well, it's going to depend on the time of day, but on average, 20, kind of making up these numbers, right? If I knock on 20 doors and if I'm in it's the evening, then I'm probably going to get 13 of them to answer, right? And of those 13, 10 of them are actually going to be homeowners, decision makers. And of those 10, I'm going to set appointments with probably 6 or 7 of them because I'm really good at setting appointments. And of those 6 or 7, I'm going to have 1 to 2 drop off that don't keep their appointment. So maybe I only have 4 or 5 appointments. 4 or 5 appointments, I close 90% of the people that'll listen to me. So let's call it 3 deals. I make 10 grand a deal. So I made 30 grand and then I trace it all back. Okay. How long did it take me to knock on 20 doors? 5 minutes apiece, an hour, I don't know, right? I mean, it's way longer than that because you're talking to people. Let's call it 4 hours. 4 hours to knock your doors and have those conversations. How long did it take to set up the appointment, to the cancellation? Okay, well, what about the follow-up appointments? Because even when they sign, I still have to spend another 2 or 3 hours to make sure. Then you calculate it. Okay, I spent 30 hours and I made 3 sales. That's 30 grand. So I'm worth $1,000 an hour. And then it's, hey, Bennett, our books are in a mess. You know, can you get in there and clean it up? And it's like, no, I could go knock more doors and make the company $1,000 an hour. And I could pay somebody $28 an hour. So I'm going to make the company $980 an hour more by refusing to do the books.
That is exactly what I'm talking about, Bennett. We have what Bennett's saying here is understand what your value is and outsource some of this work. Because we have a lot of sales reps, you know, sales executives who listen to this show. And sometimes they'll come to me and say, hey, Damon, I'm gonna take a PTO day so I can go paint the garage or something like that. Well, what is your time worth, right? So first of all, you could pay somebody $20 an hour, $30 an hour to get that done. If you're making $400 or $500 an hour when it comes to focusing on sales-related opportunities and taking that even a step back, I loved how you were talking about, okay, well, how many calls do I need to make to get as many leads that I need to have in order to close an opportunity? It's putting that all together because when you do that, you understand what it's going to take to hit your pipeline or whatever it is your goal is. So I think that's brilliant.
I think it really gives you the clarity, and especially in sales, when you start every day with $0, if I don't find somebody to agree with me that this product solves their needs, I don't make any freaking money. So and then you're knocking doors in the morning and nobody's answering. But if you're like, law of averages, I'm worth $1,000 an hour, not this hour right now, but on average. So that allows you to keep pushing. And, you know, same thing with investment, same thing with anything. If you know your numbers, how many people to have to outreach, then it's like, okay, I got 19 no's. I'm probably close to a yes. Maybe I'll get another 19 no's, but then I'll probably get 2 yeses in a row because I know law of averages apply.
Let's walk through your journey at Dirty Dough, because my understanding is you didn't know anything about cookies, food, or even franchising.
I did pest control. The next year I did satellite. The next year I did security systems and smart homes. The next year I did solar. And I purposely transitioned every single year due to the 80-20 principle of like, I'm going to learn 80% of the skills, the leadership, the knowledge that I need to know from this company, from this product, from this leadership group in the first summer, in the first year? So I purposely like was moving for knowing that that was the quicker path to learning. That led me up to the solar company, which, you know, I was making decent money. The Dirty Dough was started in Arizona. A guy that was a buddy of mine in high school posted on Facebook, I needed an investor. I invested, never spoke with him. He opened up the store and then I was pushing him to franchise it. And he said, I don't want to franchise it. I'm done. Like, this is hard. This sucks. And yes, so this goes back to your comment. I've never been in food. I didn't know the difference between a franchisee, a franchisor. I didn't know any franchise concepts because I didn't know anything about it. But I thought,
I think that's awesome, by the way.
I thought, what the hell? Like, it, pest control wasn't that much different than security, but it is, right? It's completely different. It's energy versus pest control, but it was the same to me. And satellite was the same. So because I was kind of transitioning industries and I'm like, I could do multiple million in sales year one, regardless of the product, why couldn't I do that with food? Because general business is general business. So then it's, okay, do I take the time to go be an expert in cookies? I could, and that's completely fine. Or do I find an expert and kind of hire the experts around me? So anyways, I bought the company with the intent to franchising it. And I think the key there was recognizing, I mean, it wasn't hard to recognize I didn't know anything. So nothing to face with that reality. And then do I want to go learn it all myself or do I want to hire people? And it's a mixture of two, right? But I started bringing on advisors. First advisor, John Richards, had a company called InfoSpace. When it went public, it was $31 billion. You know, like,
wow.
Holy crap, that's a guy that knows how to take a company public and rapid growth. Then he brought in my second advisor. Steve Hart owns the largest property management franchisor in the world. He's a franchising expert. And then I brought in a CEO that's been doing this for 40 years in the franchise space. So that was kind of the journey to, I guess, give me the confidence knowing that I knew so little about this space.
But Bennett, first of all, one of the things I hear you saying is that you had the self-awareness to know that, hey, I don't have all the answers to all these different areas. You know, my strength might be in sales. Maybe it's not in logistics or operations or franchising. So that's awesome. But how did you go out and land those board members? I mean, that's
go back to
in itself.
It's crazy. I'm looking back. I'm like, these guys.
I admire you for that. That's awesome.
So I'm taking the startup course right after I sell my solar company, and it's this John Richards guy. So I paid for a plane ticket and a hotel and all of this. And I was on top of the world. I was 28 years old, just sold a solar company, had a 7-figure exit. Like, what do I need a startup course for? Take the startup course. And I realized I know nothing. I didn't even know what an advisory board was. I think of a board like a bunch of old people in like a wooden room making decisions. I don't know. And he's like, no, an advisory board, you give very small portions of your equity, typically a half to 1% equity over a 2-year vesting period. And what vesting means is that, Damon, if I bring you on as an advisor and I'm like, here's a percent equity over 2 years. So you have to stick with me for 2 years. Every 6 months, you're going to secure 25%. So after 6 months, if you find a better opportunity or you're no longer adding value and I terminate the advisor relationship, then I only walked away with 6 months worth of value. So I'm only giving away 0.25%. So you're really protected as a company when you bring on these advisors, if you do it correctly. Now, how do you get them? You get good at sales, right? Why in the world would he be an advisor for a company with one store? I already hired a few corporate employees. We were losing money. We weren't a franchise yet, but I said, this is what I'm going to do, you know? So it was really selling the vision. And how did I do that? With professional communication skills, which I feel like I got through door to door. And then once I got him, then it's referrals, right? Back to door to doors. That's the best in any sales. You get referrals. John, how do I build the rest of my advisory board? And he brought on Steve Hart. And then I'm like, okay, now I got two. And he goes, you need three. You need an odd number. Okay. Tracy, she was my first employee on the corporate side, worked for Mrs. Fields. Who do you know? I know Jill Summer Hayes. She ran Maui Wowie Smoothies and Coffee, 650 franchises opened. Then she sold it. She'd be a great advisor. I called Jill, asked her to be advisor. She said, I need to be CEO. And I said, done. Sold. You could come in as CEO. But it's selling the vision and then asking for referrals.
Which is fantastic. So now you have this wonderful advisory board. What is one lesson around business that you learned from them outside of just dirty dough, but just from surrounding yourself with people who've had such tremendous success?
First one that comes to mind is from John Richards. And it was, you know, right at the beginning, we're in a lawsuit with Crumble. We've sold hundreds of franchises. We have one store open. Every private equity, you know, this is 2022, money's still, you know, very frothy, or 2021, whenever it was. And everybody's reaching out. Hey, do you want money? Do you want money? You know, and everybody else is like, no, you don't need the money. Don't take it because, you know, your equity is going to be worth so much in the future. Well, you talk with somebody who does have that so much money in the future, John Richards. And he says, look, if you own 80% of a company that has 100 units, or if you own 40% of a company that has 100 units, your lifestyle doesn't change. After after you've covered your bases, whether you have a $10 million exit or a $50 million exit, it doesn't matter. Your lifestyle won't change. So instead, focus on the lifestyle now. And it's like, how will it help you? How will you sleep at night today if you took a little extra money? And that was very surprising because, again, everybody else is the opposite. Protect the equity, protect the equity. That was one from John Richards. Another one that really helped me out when I took up that startup course was tell everybody about your idea. This whole, I need an NDA signed before I could share shit. It's like,
Forget it. Yeah.
Tell me who you know that knows somebody that knows somebody that happened to. You know, here's my business idea and my financials, and they went and stole the idea. It just doesn't really happen because the business idea isn't what's unique. It's the execution of it. So because of that, I really, right when I franchised, I'd already pre-sold 100 franchises. And like that, do you like this idea, right? Because he completely stripped that fear, and I had that fear. I'm not going to tell people what I'm doing. I don't want to people know that I'm going to do a centralized production and have the most simple food concept in the world because of this, you know? And it was really, really helpful. Just get out there, tell everybody your problems, and you'll find more solutions, and don't be embarrassed by them.
I couldn't agree with you more. My dad was like that. Whenever, you know, he opened up a bunch of different businesses, and he would be out there telling everybody he wasn't worried about them stealing it. It helps you refine your idea anyways, and people give you pushback and ideas on how to evolve it, which is awesome. Now, let's talk a little bit about the lawsuit with Crumble. What I understand, and you could walk us through it, but there's something I talk about in my book called possibility spotting. And what that is you take a negative situation and you make it a positive. You work with your constraints and you make it a positive. You turn this lawsuit into a huge growth driver for Dirty Dough.
What does it take to be like a professional communicator? I'm still thinking about that question and how it relates to my business now. And I think the best salespeople are the people that can, one, identify problems the best, and you do that by asking questions. And then isolating the problem. And so now I know that we're talking about the same thing.
And listening.
And then you solve the problem in a unique way, right? And you're not looking at, you're able to see everything from both points. Here's the downside and here's the upside. I'm going to tell you both of them, but I know I'm going to put the upside a little bit more and have you agree with me there. So I think in general, that's what I did with the lawsuit, right? Okay, what's the actual problem? But what's the actual problem? What's actually happening? But why are they doing that? You know, 100 times, really diving in. I'm like, okay, this is bullshit, you know? And then it's not like my plan was to go public with it and get public support. A local news article picked it up, you know? So then it's like, okay, again, what's the problem? My problem is now everybody's going to be like, oh, I don't want to buy a franchise because you're getting sued by a $1 billion company. So I have to tell the story around it. And it's a bullshit lawsuit. I can't talk right now. Because of XYZ, you know, and I actually broke down the lawsuit on LinkedIn every single point, but it was just me being out front with it. So once I was out front with it, like tagging Crumble, I tagged Crumble and we put up billboards right on that. We're both like across the main freeway. There's just one freeway in Utah, and like we could see each other. Anyways, they put up some billboards, you know, number one cookie company, fastest growing franchise, blah, blah, blah. And then we put up billboards that said, cookies so good, we're being sued. You know, our cookies don't crumble with the competition. Let your taste buds be the judge, things like that. So having fun with it, you know, so, and then just being out there, again, not shying away from problems, And it's like, what do you do? What do you do when you get sued? Well, you just go out there and ask other people, what do you do? What would you do? And I did a lot of that, got a lot of good feedback, but people just liked the humor and I guess the nerve of just like, wait, Dirty Dough's at one store, zero franchises, Crumbles doing $1 billion in revenue.
And they're suing you.
And you guys are still fighting, you know?
That's awesome. And when you went to take the humor out on it and putting up the billboards and everything, did you get any pushback from your board or who's like, I don't know if this is a good idea, or were they the ones who came up with it?
There's nobody that said you should poke fun of a $1 billion company in their own backyard. But this was always my question. Again, why? I'm a why guy. Why not? Oh, well, you know, because they're going to be mad. And it's like, okay, well, then what? Are they going to sue me? Like, they're already suing me. You know, like my question was always, is it illegal? If it's not illegal, I'm going to do it. Right. But yeah, I would say pretty much everybody said no on any of those strategies. We also paid actors to do professional commercials. There's a brand called the Squatty Potty that had a really viral video quite a, you know, 10 years ago, a unicorn pooping rainbow ice cream.
Come on.
It's so funny. The same guy that produced that, we hired him. If you haven't checked out the videos, they did an amazing job. It's the big cookie co showing up to a lemonade stand and suing kids. And they're like, how many cookies, you know, what are your flavors like? And the kid's like, I don't know, just whatever my mom makes this week. And they're like, weekly cookie rotations, lawsuit, you know, because they sued us over weekly rotational cookies in a bakery. Like they came up with that first. So we took out every instance of the lawsuit and it made it funny, but it wasn't like, here's general concepts. I attacked each issue in the lawsuit head on through both videos, billboards, and LinkedIn. And it's just like full visibility. I could be wrong, but here, you decide for yourself.
And then, so people just started jumping on board like, hey, this is cool. I now that Dirty Dough's on the radar. And so you just started getting a bunch of franchisees. What is it called? Franchisees.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you coming to you? No, I can't talk. Yeah.
The franchisee is the person who's going to open up that specific location in their specific market. So they own the McDonald's in Salt Lake City, but they don't own McDonald's as a brand. That's the franchise or side. So that's kind of the difference between the two. Now, I mean, I'd already done the, hey, Damon, if I came up with a cookie franchise and I did, and if I centralized the production, if I did this, if I reduced the labor, if I made the startup cost a third of Crumble, you could operate at 500 square feet. So your risk is less. And I could mitigate waste by using day-old cookies and ice cream products. And if I could do all this, would you be interested? And you're like, yeah, I like that. I don't like that. Well, I did that so many times. We franchised. We'd sold 60 franchises in the first 6 months. Pretty unheard of. Lawsuit happens. And it gave us millions of eyes. Now, the millions of eyes wouldn't have helped unless, for me, I already had my two foundations covered. Why are people buying Dirty Doughs? Number one, I think we have the most simplistic food franchise model. Here's a cookie, put it in the oven. We have Dirty Doughs in 25 states. You could operate any of them by walking in, grabbing any cookie, putting it on the cookie sheet, put it in the oven, press start. Everything cooks to the same time, temperature, fan speed. So, like, very easy. We already had that established. And then we already had the team. Nobody wants to buy a franchise from me, but maybe they do from a Jill Summer Hayes. So we already had both of those things in place. And then we just needed the eyes to then fuel the growth, right? But the business strategy was kind of, the fundamentals were already there. So when we got the eyes, we went from selling 60 franchises in the first 6 months. The next 6 months, we sold 230. So we went
That's
from
crazy.
60 to 290. Yeah. And it was definitely from our reaction to that lawsuit.
That's amazing. Now, you're a sales guy, right? That's your strength. We talked about that, you know, you brought on this board, but you were able to come in to Dirty Dough and centralize, I guess, logistics and operations and everything. Was that a lot of your thinking or was that just understanding there had to be a better way to do it? And so having people around you who were able to come up with those types of ideas to make things more efficient and simpler?
Yeah, both. I think a lot of it comes from me and you have a big advantage going into an industry with no background. It's not like, oh, this is what I did at Buffalo Wild Wings, so we're going to do it here. It's like,
I love that.
What do we do? You know, there's a million options. So we did pivot, like the centralized production I thought was the key because I'm a salesperson. What do people want to buy? They want to buy a system with lower risk, lower labor, lower waste. Like I know that I've already gone out and I've gotten the feedback. So now I need to go create that. Now I can't do that by myself because I don't know the know-how, but what I did do really well is vet the market and see what people were looking for in a franchise. And then I created that rather than, and I think that's the salesperson way, right? I'm going to ask the questions and then solve it. And I have the freedom to solve it however I want because I own the company, rather than here's grandma's recipe. It has to stay the same. Let's go figure out how to market this. It's like, no, let's go figure out what people want and then give it to them rather than try to fit a, you know, round peg in a square hole per se.
Yeah. Have you ever read the book Steal Like an Artist?
I haven't.
It's a great book. You could probably read it in an hour. And it's great because it talks about you don't need to reinvent the wheel or start from scratch. You could go out and look in all these different areas and figure out what other people are doing in other industries or whatever and bring it into the industry you're in. And I always think it's so good. I always recommend to the people I coach or work with, you know, look outside of your specific industry and learn from them and be open-minded to changing and doing things differently, which sounds like it's exactly what you have done to be able to streamline your operations there.
I've looked at all the franchises. I mean, if I shared my screen right now, you'll see three tabs. And I have franchise disclosure documents from other companies. You can look them up if they franchise in California or Indiana or whatever. And then you scroll down to their item 19, which is, they call them items, their sections. Every section 19 in a franchise disclosure document shows their financials if they did choose to disclose it. So I get to go and see all of the competitors, what their startups cost, what their fees are, what they're making. Nobody else is doing that, which is crazy. I'm like, this is just me and ChatGTP. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't, it's nothing special. It's public information, but nobody's doing that. And maybe because they think they kind of already know, but when you come in knowing that you don't know anything, I'm like, no, I need to really dive into it. Or like, Damon, if you're talking to me about a franchise, again, I do think it's really diving into the curiosity of like, what do you want? What's worked for you in the past? And specifically not shying away from problems. Oh, I had a franchise in the past. It was terrible. It was H&R Block. They charged me 30%. This is a conversation I had 2 days ago. Well, why are you interested in franchising again? You know, because like he's starting off like, I'm not really interested. Like, what the hell are you on this call for? And not being afraid to really dive in deep to those issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And even before you said it, I was going to bring it up. I mean, you're a curious person, right? Being curious and also being able to take a step back and say, hey, maybe I don't have all the answers. So let me get curious and see if there's different ways to do this or what's out there. Speaking of franchisees, who are the target audience? Who do you look for a franchise? Is it somebody who wants to do it as a side job? Is it somebody who spent their whole career being in franchisee, owning a franchise? Or who tends to have the most success, I guess, is my question.
I would say, I mean, if I could wave a magic wand, we're only selling franchises to people who are buying five at a time, no more, no less. I think that's a really good number. They have experience in food and franchising. Now, the cons to that is they bring a lot of like, oh, we did this at Chick-fil-A, you know, but it's, you can manage that. The pros are it's business. They know how to run business. They know how to run food. And it makes the sell so much easier. If you've ran a Subway and you've kept track of 18 different vegetables that go bad at the end of every day, and then I tell you, hey, I'm going to ship you a frozen cookie that with no preservatives can stay in your, they're typically going to, you know, rotate out every 2 to 3 months, but third party tested, we have an 18 month shelf life. You know, oh, well, what about your day old cookies? You know, what do you do with that? Rather than throwing them away, we keep them and then we sell them the next day in a cookie shake. So like those people appreciate those little changes more because they're like, oh my gosh, I'm comparing it to a Chick-fil-A when I have 50 people. And I'm like, no, you only need one or two people, 500 square feet. So it's also easier to sell those people. Now, there's nothing wrong with somebody getting into it, you know, mom and pop type, you know, opening up a store. I think a mistake that I did when I bought Dirty Dough, I ran it from San Diego because I had my solar company there and it went good because I know how to run a business. You know, I know how to call the manager every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 30 minutes, review KPIs, review budgets, what her labor was. And I managed it remotely. And then it was, hey, if you know how to do business, it could be a semi-passive investment opportunity. Well, other people are like, okay, semi-passive means I could hire a 22-year-old college girl that used to work at Five Guys and then never talked to the store again. So no, you have to be active in your business. Active doesn't mean you're working 40 or 60 hours a week, but active means you know your numbers, you're meeting with your managers and all of that. But anyways, generally speaking, multi-unit operators are the best. If it's a mom and pop just looking to get into it for the first time, I love that because it is a lower cost option than most franchises out there. But they just need to make sure that they are following the system and hustling.
Okay, so now there is, what is there currently, about 85 Dirty Dough's with 250 potential?
Yeah, 450 that we've sold. Yeah, and 80 some of them are opened up. And then we have 17 trailers, so like food trucks.
That's awesome. How has it been as far as scaling, being able to keep the same, the same culture, the same vibe? Is that super difficult to do? I mean, how do you get it? Like when Learn It opened up 8 locations, I'll be honest, I really struggled having the same feel as we did in San Francisco, as I did in Phoenix, as I did in Seattle.
Yes, that is very difficult. I'm all like, okay, we need to just manage everything and we have cameras and we haven't implemented the AI, but the cameras that we've installed are capable of AI. So it's the answer is I don't know, but this is what I'm thinking and this is the direction we're going. If I have a script and I know that I'm focusing on, you know, the highest percentage of people possible that come through my door, I want them to use the loyalty program, right? They're getting discounts and then I'm getting repeat customers. It's a win-win. Well, if I could measure who the cashier is at the time and see what her loyalty attachment rate is, I know if they're asking the question or not. You can also use audio through the camera, similar to Google Voice, the way I understand it. It's not listening to you in this or recording so much, but it'll give you the keywords. Like it'll tell you if they ask the question or not. Would you like something to drink with that? That's something that if you're at a 1% drink sales, I know you're not asking that. You know what I mean? So really getting granular onto which employee, what their metrics are, and then knowing, okay, do I need to train this employee specifically on greeting the customer and making sure they do that and they bring up one compliment or whatever that store does. That's what my brother does in his Poway Dirty Dough. Try to give him one compliment, right? And then determine, do I need to train that employee or replace them more? So that's kind of the store level. Where my mind initially went was at a company level. I have no idea how to do that either. That's even harder. I'm just hiring people and hoping that they do it. I'm terrible at the culture aspect of it, I think.
So what is next for Dirty Dough and you?
Yeah, Dirty Dough, we're adding, I just got the list yesterday, 20 stores right now are adding dirty drinks. So like sodas that you could add coconut cream and raspberry puree, things like that. Expanding the product line to get more frequent customers, knowing that, you know, people aren't buying a $4 cookie, 500 calories and eating that every day. So that's exciting. We're now a Craveworthy brand. Craveworthy is ran by Greg Majewski, who was Jimmy John's CEO, from 20 something locations up to 300 open, 700 sold. It's like that was the heavy lifting. If you look at percentage growth over the last 30 years, they're the number one food franchise in the world. So it's like, what do you do? You know, take that playbook and then now apply it to these smaller brands. So like a Dirty Dough, as soon as we became a Craveworthy brand, our fees on Uber Eats and DoorDash went down by like 28% or something like that. So it's like, sweet. So a lot of growth now that Craveworthy fully acquired Dirty Dough just 6 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That they're in it. I've stepped over to the director of franchise development sales for their other brands. They have 6 brands that they're franchising. So I'm focusing on that, which is, it's fun. I honestly love offering multiple products because it's like, if the Dirty Dough is not for you, here's something else that fits you a little bit better, whether it's style or investment or market capability. And I think it's always better to offer a few options. So I'm excited about that.
So I wanted to pivot over in our last couple of minutes here around mental health. You've put a big emphasis on that, both personally, and you got a great podcast on it called, what's it called? It's called Deeper Than the Dough. Deeper Than the Dough. So let's talk about why mental health is so important.
3 years ago is when I sold my solar company, and I had a great time doing solar because I was working so much. I mean, I didn't even pay attention to life, I don't think. 5'8", I got up to 310 pounds. So I wasn't healthy. I couldn't, I mean, my eyes were squinty because my cheeks were so fat. I thought I had a good relationship with my wife. If you ask her, she's like, no, we were roommates. But I'm like, but we didn't fight. That's a good relationship, right? Anyways, I realized I sacrificed everything for the $1 million goal. I wanted to be a millionaire before 30. Why? I have no idea. Like really, truly, just because I thought it sounded cool, right? Well, I achieved it. And then I learned how the brain works. And you have dopamine that gives you feelings of pleasure as an anticipation of the reward. And once you get that reward, in order you to feel dopamine again from smelling a flower or eating food or selling your business, it's all dopamine. Your dopamine levels have to reset to zero again, meaning that joy is not going to last. That $1 million cool, it's going to be short lived. So when I realized that, I realized, okay, I'm doing life wrong. I've only been on numbers, facts, figures, left intuition aside, because I'm not an emotional creature. I'm a logical creature. And then logically analyzing my life, logically, there's never been an action that I've done that wasn't after an emotional outcome, right? I don't want $1 million. I want to feel a certain way. So that's when mental health started becoming really important to me as an individual. As a father, it was much more scary. We were talking about this a little bit above the show. It was just listening to a podcast showing suicide rates, self-harm rates from 2010 to 2015. What happened during that time period? Everybody got Facebook and cell phones. Kids did, right?
Terrible.
Then it's like, okay, well, we're just reporting higher levels of depression and anxiety because society is we're open to it. So people are just more comfortable. And he says, no, that's not the case, because the hospitalization rates due to self-harm in girls 9 to 14 has increased by 189% during that 5-year span. So I'm like, I got two daughters. You're telling me that they're 189% more likely to go to the hospital than they were in 2010 due to self-harm. What the hell do you do with that? So that's been a big focus, and I'm glad I got into it 3 years ago, because life crushed me at the beginning of this year. And I had to lean into it more and more and realize the key to life isn't solving your problems and then you feel good. The key to life is figuring out why you have so many problems in the first place and reframing problem, because your brain will always search for problems so then it could solve it. That's what it's designed to do. And you need to recognize that to jump out of it. And if you can, then you're allowed to, I guess, look at business from a different perspective. Not so much as a life of death. Your body's not always reacting and it's sympathetic nervous system, sweating, heart rate up, blood pressure up. And you can make much better decisions and you can work less time and less stress if you sharpen the saw, so to speak. And the saw is definitely your mind.
And we're always going to have problems. I mean, you can't avoid that. Do you have any tips that you could share with our listeners on how they could learn to make better decisions?
I would say know what your goal is. So my goal was $1 million. So I was making decisions based on that. Do I take my wife to date or do I work? Well, my goal is $1 million. I'm going to work, right? Then I reevaluated all that and I set a new goal with a therapist based on what I actually think I'm after. And turns out I think most people are after the same thing. Joy and fulfillment, despite life's dirtiness. I threw that in there. That means don't wait to sell your solar company to have that joy and fulfillment. So now that I've determined that, now I can look at, do I work? Do I go knock more doors? Or do I go on a date with my wife? Well, which one's going to bring me more joy and fulfillment? The date with my wife, hands down. I freaking love being with her, of course. But that first goal, what I'm trying to point out is it was just like step one to a 10-step goal. And step 10 is joy and fulfillment. So identify that step 10 goal. If you had all the money in the world, how would you feel on a day-to-day basis? What would you be doing? But really focus on the feeling. And then that's how you make your decisions. What's going to get me closer to that emotional targeted state that I'm after?
I think that's great. And one of the things that you said right there that I want to point out is that you can't go from step one to step 10. Like right away, you just got to kind of work in that direction, which is so important.
What I was trying to point out is you got to know what step and is, most people in setting goals, I mean, I agree with what you're saying, but most people set the step one, I want to be a millionaire, and they think it's step 10. They think that's the end. They think that's going to give them everything that they're after. And the reality is, ask anybody who has $1 million, and 10 out of 10 times, they're going to tell you no.
I've been around some individuals who, a lot of individuals just like you have, who make hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're absolutely miserable. So even though you need money, of course, there's got to be more to life than that. Because if you're not, then you can end up having a miserable life and not being in your kid's life and divorced a couple times. And you got to really put it all into perspective about what's most important, and, you know, and also what you want your legacy to be. What do you want your legacy to be?
That's a really good question. That's a question that I ask people quite a bit. I'm maybe going to redo my mission statement here. Rather than join fulfillment, I'm moving away from fulfillment, because I think in Western culture, only in the last few hundred years, the concept of progression for fulfillment has emerged. I don't think that that's a true concept. I think that's a myth that just is, I have to be doing something or else I'm not going to be happy. And you can be happy without doing something. So then what's life about if it's not so much about the joy and fulfillment? I think it's about fun and learning. I think it's about, I mean, if you, I like fun more than joy, because if you're having fun, yeah, you're living a joyful life and not trying to take anything too seriously. So legacy for me is, I think it's more fun and learning. And I think the biggest way to give that legacy or fulfill that legacy is through my kids and really teaching them those concepts. And I absolutely love teaching my five-year-old when she's crying and saying, hey, sorry that you're feeling bad. Like, do you want me to help you change your state? No. Okay, cool. Let them cry. Yes. And then you can walk them through science-based activities on like how to lower their heart rate almost instantly. Just different thought, you know, meditation practices that five-year-olds can do. Anyways, that's what I want my legacy to be, because that's so fun for me.
So as we wrap up here, any final words for our audience?
Yeah, last thing is going to be business is hard. And if you tell yourself, as long as I solve all my problems, then I'll be happy, I think you're on the wrong path. Instead, I would employ anybody to like dive into their emotional state. If you could see a therapist, go see a therapist and just like, what am I after? Nail that down and then make sure that what you're doing on a day-to-day basis aligns with that. So yeah, just really set that end goal, I guess. That's my advice.
What I like to say is there's nothing wrong with going to see a therapist. You know, I mean, that's, you're just trying to better yourself more than anything and get familiar. So to recap, kind of like what we talked about today, knocking on doors, you know, how important that is and learning from sales. We talked a lot about franchising and surrounding yourself with great people and getting out of your comfort zone and being curious and learning from others and taking chances. But most importantly, figure out what your true goals are in life. And if you're saying it's $1 million or $2 million, why is that? And how does that affect everybody else around you? And what will make you really happy in the future? So Bennett, where can our listeners connect with you at?
BennettMaxwell.com has links to anything to do with franchising on any of the brands, social media, my podcast. I do a monthly entrepreneurship newsletter as well. So anyways, there you could get a bunch of free content on listening to me talk about stuff I don't even really know.
Right there with you, man. And you gotta pick up some dirty dough along the way too. Let's not
absolutely
forget that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go get some cookies.
Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. This has been awesome. And so listeners out there, check out Bennett's website, check out his podcast, you know, Deeper Than Dough. And until next time, everybody, stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day.